A surprise announcement from three-term Senator Olympia Snowe sparks a mad scramble in the world of Maine politics. Wednesday's announcement that Snowe would not seek a fourth term, citing frustration with the growing partisan rift in Washington, and Congress in particular, has brought national focus to Maine, where Democrats see a prime opportunity to win back a valuable political prize. Here at home, there's a frenzied game of musical chairs, as would-be candidates scramble to assess their chances in a Senate bid, or in the two House races that could be open when the music stops. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on Maine Calling, NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, Colby College political science professor Sandy Maisel, and veteran political reporter Pat Callahan of WCSH-TV in Portland. We'd like to hear from you as well. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post to our Maine Calling Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. A major shakeup in Maine politics. What does it mean? This is Maine Calling. And welcome to the program. An extended version of Maine Calling today. We're going till 2 o'clock, and we have some special guests, as we mentioned in the open. Ron Elving is senior Washington editor for NPR, and Sandy Maisel, of course, a political science professor at Colby College. A lot to get to, because a lot has happened in the last 48 hours or so, as Maine's senior senator, Olympia Snowe, who has been in Congress for over 30 years and is announced Wednesday that she is no longer interested in keeping that Senate seat. And that has set off a chain reaction of activity, as people have been saying they're going to jump into the race or shift over to from a House race to the Senate. And we're going to get into all of that today. We also want to take your calls, talk a little bit about some of the reasons that the senator is given for jumping out of that Senate seat that she's held now for three terms. And primarily, her concern that Washington has become just too politically divided. She's prided herself as a centrist throughout her career and has basically kind of said that it's just too difficult to do that. And joining us now is Sandy Maisel of Colby College. Sandy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Appreciate you coming on today. I'm sure you've had a lot of requests for interviews.
Been a busy couple of days.
Yeah, but it's an exciting time. I mean, this really was unexpected. There's that element. But whenever a Senate seat opens up, it's a big deal, in particular when it really opens up the political possibilities across the spectrum. How do you see this?
Well, it is a huge deal. One of the reasons it's a big deal is Maine tends to keep their senators in for as long as they want to stay. The last time Maine defeated a senator was in 1978 when Senator Cohen beat Senator Hathaway. And then Senator Cohen stayed until he left. Senator Mitchell stayed until he left. Senator Snowe has stayed until she has decided to leave, and Senator Collins has been reelected handily. So it is a big opportunity for Maine people in Maine who are interested in serving the public.
What a lot of what I've been reading is that this is seen as the Democrats having a real opportunity to take back that seat. Is it that cut and dried? I mean, we will have the election after all. And
a big opportunity is, you know, relative to what? If Senator Snowe had remained on the ballot, the Democrats had no opportunity because she was going to win re-election handily. So that it went from a seat in which the Republicans thought they could win without it extending much energy, certainly not from Washington. Senator Snowe would have run a vigorous campaign, but the National Republican Party would not have had to worry about it. And the Democrats went from a seat when the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee had written it off as a lost cause to probably one of the highest seats on their priority list right now, a rare opportunity to take a Republican seat.
The number to join the conversation today, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll bring on Ron Elving in a few minutes. Timing. This, of course, has set off a frenzy because the senator as I understand it, even surprised her own staff in announcing this on Wednesday.
I understand she told her staff a half an hour before they released the publication.
And so this also comes at a time, though, when there's a very short window for candidates to get in, get the signatures they need, get those signatures verified, and get on to the ballot. What's your take on the timing? She was aware that this would happen. Why did she do it now?
Well, I wouldn't presume to understand exactly why she did it at the time that she did. She says that on her birthday, which was on the 21st, she sort of thought ahead and said, you know, I'm 65 now, I'll be 71 at the end of the next term. Maybe this doesn't make any sense for the reasons that she said in her statement. On the other hand, to do it with 2 weeks' notice certainly gives her former chief of staff a leg up in the Republican nominating contest if he decides to go for it. Former Senate President Ray is organized already and has signatures gathered already to run for the second congressional district, but he has an organization in place, and I think he could gather signatures to run for the Senate much more easily than could any other Republican.
So there's been speculation that maybe she, and of course we don't do speculation here, but maybe we'll allow for it just this one time, that she might have made it easier for Senator Ray, knowing that he had the infrastructure to get his act together, I guess you'd say, whereas others might not.
I think we can say she did make it easier for him. Whether that was her intent or not, we can't say. But she certainly has made it in the Republican Party much easier for him to get on the ballot than for anybody else.
She cites the partisan divide as the reason for choosing not to run again after 3 decades in Congress, 3 terms in the Senate. Is it your take that it really is just that different than it was even 6 years ago?
I think that the extent to which discourse in the Congress has become uncivil has been escalating. I don't think it started just 6 years ago. I don't even think it started with the Tea Party. I think you can go back to the 1994-1996 period, but it has gotten much worse in the last 2 to 4 years. And it's been much worse intra-party as well as inter-party, which is to say that if you are not, you know, right in line with your party, there are people in your party who are treating you as if you were a pariah.
Let's bring in Ron Elving into the conversation. Ron Elving is NPR News Senior Washington Editor. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it. Just before you came on, we were talking about the reason cited by Senator Snow for deciding not to seek a fourth term, and that is the partisan rift and her frustration with that, I guess it seemed to be sort of increasing inability to get beyond that rift and to really be effective in a lot of ways. And my question to Sandy Maisel of Colby College had been, is it really that much different than it was 6 years ago? Has that divide really made it difficult for moderates like Snow?
Yes, I believe it has been. It has become more difficult and has been moving in that direction for a number of years. And I think what she's looking at more than anything else is the anticipation of where it will go in the next 6 years. She may very well be thinking beyond just the immediate situation that she's in right now, which is bad enough. We just saw a very highly partisan vote on the floor of the Senate here in the last hour, where the Senate voted on the Blunt Amendment having to do with contraception. 51-48 is an awfully close vote on something of that nature, and not a lot of party crossover in that particular vote. If you look back, as you say, 6 years or back a decade, you had a body of people in the Republican Party, George Voinovich, for example, Arlen Specter, who later became a Democrat, a number of others who, along with Olympia Snowe and to some degree Susan Collins, represented a sort of bridge between the two parties. And as that bridge has been dismantled one person after another, it's gotten to the point where I think Olympia Snowe was afraid she and Susan Collins would be almost by themselves in the new Congress. And it gets very hard to accomplish anything when you're the last person stuck trying to hold up the bridge by yourself.
But at the same time, Ron, they do get a lot of attention, even in this blunt vote of a half an hour ago now. We both learned in the stories how Snow and Collins both voted because they're pivotal swing votes. In that way, don't they actually get more attention than being part of a block? And don't they aren't they more powerful in some ways?
That has always been the sense. Well, I don't know how many stories that I have heard or worked on over the years that said that the power fulcrum in the Senate or the pivot point in the Senate was going to be that handful of moderates, particularly Republican moderates, the kind of people I was talking about a moment ago, throw in some of the Democrats who have been somewhat gettable votes for the Republicans. Take, for example, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, who is also retiring, same timing, or on some other issues, say a Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, who is also retiring, same timing. Right now, Joe Manchin, who replaced Bob Byrd in West Virginia. That group of people, they supposedly held this magic power in the middle of the Senate. But in the end, time after time, we've seen year after year where, in the end, that little group of people in the middle, they don't hold together. They get picked off by their party leadership. They get pressured into voting on one side or the other. There is really no third vote besides aye or nay. And so they wind up not really having the kind of power that people would think they might have. I mean, you can look back at the stimulus bill in 2009 that Olympia Snow voted for, Arlen Specter voted for. How much influence did they have in changing that bill or making it more compatible for Republicans?
I think the last time they had that kind of influence, and Ron, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I think the last time they thought they had that kind of influence was when the Gang of 14 was together on judicial nominations, and they said they would hold together and held the balance of power.
That needed more than a dozen people. Well, had 14, and it needed to be something along that size, and that was back in the presidency of George W. Bush. I'm going to try to guess at a year here, Sandy. I think it was 2004, 5, thereabouts, 2005.
Yeah, I think something that it was
similar. The Gang of 14 emerged.
Beginning of the second term, I think.
So about 2005.
And Ron, you were saying that you suspected that maybe she's concerned about what's going to happen in the next 6 years. What are the indicators that the next 6 years are going to continue this sort of problem that she cites?
Well, you see this list of people who are retiring. You're losing 10 senators out of this current group, and seven of those are Democrats. They include Ben Nelson, whom I alluded to, Joe Lieberman, James Webb from Virginia, who is a guy who was elected as a Democrat but had also been associated with the Reagan administration and been a sub-cabinet member there. Kent Conrad from North Dakota, a liberal Democrat on a few issues, but also a leading deficit hawk and somebody who would certainly define himself as a kind of centrist. You could say the same of Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico on many, many issues, has been simpatico with Western conservatives on energy issues and so on. All of those Democrats are leaving. And as they go, they're making it that much more difficult for any Republican who is trying to get a Democratic senator or some Democratic senators in a committee, on a committee issue, or on a floor issue to come across the aisle. On the Republican side, you're losing Kay Bailey Hutchison, who, while she would describe herself as a good Texas conservative, has been on some issues reachable for the Democrats. And now, of course, they're losing Olympia Snow.
And I think people would also argue that there's at least a middling probability that they will lose Senator Brown, who is probably the senator closest to her on issues through an electoral loss, not through resigning.
We're going to take a few calls in a moment. Ron Elving, what does this mean, though, for this ongoing control, battle over control of the Senate? Does this sort of shift that? Does it change the game plan?
I think it gives a little bit of light to the concept or the idea, the notion that the Democrats could actually contest the Senate this November. They have a chance now of holding on. Some people are looking to Nebraska and saying Bob Kerry's reversal of his decision not to run gives the Democrats a chance. I would still call that a Republican pickup. I don't think Bob Kerry's going to have the magic that he had 15, 20 years ago, but we could be wrong. And it turns out to be a Democratic year in 2012, November. It's possible Bob Kerry will charm the pants off of Nebraskans again and get back into the Senate. If so, and if the Democrats are making a pretty reasonable run at saving Kent Conrad's seat in North Dakota, even though that would still look like a Republican pickup, if you add in the prospect of beating Scott Brown in Massachusetts, which is probably a 50-50 call, if you add in a seat from Maine, suddenly the Democrats are back in the game, because they had been defending two-thirds of the 33 seats. They still are. And that's a tough, tough game. That's a tough road to hoe. And now at least they seem to have at least some chance of taking away a couple of Republican seats, and that puts them back in the ballgame.
To join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet us at Maine Calling or leave a comment on our Facebook page. We're with Ron Elving, NPR News Senior Washington Editor, and Professor Sandy Maisel of Colby College. Let's go to Biddeford and Timothy. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I think that this is a deliberate slight on Olympia Snowe's part to sort of poke the Republican Party in the eye because of the catastrophic slide of the GOP over the past 30 or 40 years in their avalanche to move to the right, and Maine being more of an independent-minded state, you know, or sometimes Democratic, sometimes Republican on issues, that Olympia Snowe no longer felt welcome in her party. And, you know, I don't think that she just figured this out yesterday. I think that maybe she'd been mulling it over for a few weeks or even a few months, and possibly even had an inkling that maybe a couple years ago, in her most recent term, that she was thinking about not running for a fourth term. Because with 2 weeks to give any GOP prospective entrance into the race time to get 2,000 signatures, although it's possible, it seems difficult for that to properly come together, for someone to organize a staff and a campaign, and without tripping over themselves to get all the paperwork in on time.
Yeah, Ron, was this a personal statement, do you think?
I'm not sure about the timing part of it. I don't know why she would not have felt the same way she has expressed in the last few days about the Senate in the last several months or 6 months or even a year. Most senators try to give their home party a little bit of warning and not leave just 2 weeks for people to scramble and replace them. I mean, if you're the out party, if you're the Democrats in Maine, you know you need a candidate against Olympia Snowe. If you're the Republicans, you assume you don't need another candidate. So for her to leave only 2 weeks suggests that this may have been a decision that came onto her radar screen much more recently, and she changed a decision that she had made maybe, say, last summer, last fall, to run again.
Timothy, are you a Snowe supporter?
Excuse me?
Did you support Senator Snowe? Did you vote for Snowe?
I did not vote for Snowe. Although, you know, I think I admire her ability to vote on both sides of the aisle. I think that, you know, sometimes she just, it seems like she does what occasionally she votes the way that she's sometimes told to vote.
Who would you vote for? We don't really know who the final list is, of course, because the ballot hasn't been determined. But of the field that's sort of emerging, is there someone you would support to take that Senate seat?
I would have to reserve my judgment until there have been some debates and see which candidate was who had the most libertarian values. You know, who would be in favor of repealing the Patriot Act? Who would be in favor of auditing the Fed? Who would be in favor of returning, the powers that the federal government has assumed upon itself back to the states as is clearly defined in the 10th Amendment? So I would be open to voting for a Democrat. I'd be open to voting for a Republican or an independent. I would just have to I'm excited about looking forward to the debates and seeing what candidates have to say about their stance on, individual liberty.
Timothy, thanks for calling us today. Ron Elving and Sandy, Timothy kind of represents, in some ways, the typical Maine voter in that they are independent and, you know, will vote on either side of a ticket. We have Democrats who will vote for Republicans, and there's a libertarian streak there as well. Is Maine? Do you see Maine as a different profile state than other states in that way?
Well, I do. I think Maine. If you look back to the 1992 presidential election, I believe Maine was one of Ross Perot's better states. I think, if I remember this correctly, Sandy can correct me. I believe that Ross Perot finished second in Maine.
He did.
And actually finished ahead of George H.W. Bush, a Maine resident. And that, I think, is a symbolic of a sense in Maine that that there is something beyond what is being offered by the two major parties that is what Maine would really prefer. And
I think
to some degree, Snow and Collins, I think, have provided that.
I think it goes even further than that. I mean, we elected an independent governor in the 70s in Jim Longley. We elected an independent governor in Angus King. Elliot Cutler came within a point and a half of being an independent governor elected in 2010. So I think you're right, Keith, that this is exactly what the Maine electorate is like. And I think part of what Senator Snow was reflecting was an inability to be effective as the person who wasn't a partisan. And she has, she's always been a strong Republican, and her husband was a strong Republican. And I think she is loyal to the Republican Party, but she also has always had this independent streak. And it became more and more difficult to voice that streak in the Senate, and she was being sniped at from the right in the Republican Party. She wasn't going to lose, but it was going to be an uncomfortable time in the Republican primary, which it should not have been.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Orland and Rufus. Hi, Rufus. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you. There's speculation that this could end in a bloodbath for Democrats if they end up, if both Michoud and Pingree go for the Senate and end up losing those two seats to Republicans. But I don't understand it. I don't see any reason why somebody would have to give up his or her House seat in order to run for the Senate in the primary. In any case, I'd like to add, I think Pingree is the Democrats' strongest candidate. She's very well liked. Baldacci is not nearly as popular now as he was 8 years ago. Michoud is strong in the second district, and I think he should stay there and hold the second district.
Right, let's get to a couple of your questions.
Part of that's pretty easy to answer. They don't have to give up their seat to run, but they can't run for another term in their seat. So that if Congressman Michoud or Congresswoman Pingree run, they stay in the House until the end of this Congress, but they can't be in the next Congress because they won't be on the ballot. So essentially they're giving up the future holding of their seat.
I don't understand. They'd be running in the primary.
Right, but they couldn't run in the they couldn't run in the Democratic primary to succeed themselves.
I see. They can't run in primaries for both seats.
If their seat is up at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. There could be
Pennsylvania is the only state in which you can do that.
I see, right. Which state?
Pennsylvania, I think.
Yeah. There are cases where, say, you know, someone's in the Senate and they run for president, but it's in the middle of their Senate term, so they're not actually
that I understand.
Yeah, yeah. So
in terms of the bloodbath question, I think that's the Democrats' greatest fear, that their greatest hope is they win the Senate seat and hold two House seats. Their greatest fear is they lose the Senate seat and lose both House seats.
Sure. Is there a risk there, Ron Elving, that the Democrats, in going for jumping into this Senate race with two candidates and creating a primary there, could risk all three?
Yes, absolutely. Mathematically, of course. But whether or not that is a realistic chance, whether or not that would be something that would really seriously restrain the Democrats from having a contest between the two House members is another question. You can see the case that each House member would make for himself or herself as the logical person to step up into the Senate seat. So that one's going to be tough to resolve. If they can resolve it, that strengthens the party overall. They get a person who's been elected by half the state and running for the Senate, well known in either case, and they also hold on in all likelihood to one of their seats safely. But if they can come up with a strong candidate in the other congressional seat, or if they can come up with one in both, the voters of Maine have been pretty friendly recently to Democrats in the House races, so they should be able to at least contest both House seats while letting these two ambitious Democrats decide which one of them is going to be the winner for the Senate seat.
And how do they decide that? How much power do the party senatorial committees or congressional committees have in saying, you know, hey, it's your turn, you go, and you, it's not your turn, wait another 2 years?
It's limited power. They can try, and in many cases, some of these people have been very persuasive. When he was running the House Campaign Committee, Rahm Emanuel picked and chose among people who were going to be candidates for the House. Chuck Schumer, when he was running the Senate Campaign Committee, picked and chose among people who might be candidates for the Senate seat nomination in the Democratic Party and favored one over the other. And the favor of those national figures can sometimes direct the predominance of funding. So fundraising is a huge issue in all races now, and so if you can get more help through the National Party, if you are the chosen person of a Chuck Schumer or somebody else who is in that position as the committee chairman, then that would obviously be a huge plus for you. But oftentimes the National Party steps back and says, hey, we just really don't want to get into that fight. You guys work it out, and if you can't work it out, you'll have to have a primary.
1-800-399-3566.
If I could just add to that,
yeah,
I think
sure,
one of the things that is interesting is, because of the short time frame, everybody has to take out papers and get those signatures in order to preserve their options. But I don't think either Congressman Michaud or Congresswoman Pingree has made a final decision about running yet. And I think it will involve looking at who is going to run in other seats. If Kevin Ray decides to run for the Senate, Congressman Michaud has a pretty much of a walk in the 2nd District. And I think he would more likely stay there. If Ray stays in the 2nd District, then that becomes a tough race, and he may decide to look at the Senate seat.
And do they look at polls in the next few days to determine what their shot might be at a statewide?
I don't think there may be a poll done in the next few days that is helpful to them, but I think they have a pretty good sense already of what their how well they're viewed favorably and what their favorable unfavorable ratio is throughout the state. And I think they would use that. And you know, these are seasoned politicians who understand that Congressman Michaud is more popular in the 2nd District, not only because he lives there, but because of he is more centrist, and Congresswoman Pingree is more popular in the 1st District, not only because she lives there, but because that's a more liberal district. Those are the things that they're looking at.
Let's talk quickly about those two candidates. Let's say that Michaud and Pingree decide to both get into that Senate race and create a Democratic primary. What are the strengths and weaknesses of each in a statewide contest?
I defer to Sandy on that for certain.
Well, I can give you some parameters on that. Congresswoman Pingree has a much broader national image. She will have it'll be much easier for her to raise money nationally. I would assume Emily's List would jump on her in a minute. As a female candidate trying to preserve a seat in the Senate held by a woman. On the other hand, she is not very well known in the 2nd Congressional District. It is not a natural constituency for her. Some of the centrist positions that Congressman Michaud has taken, particularly about dealing with the paper industry in his district, I think, you know, they would differ on that issue. Congressman Michaud, on the other hand, is considered solid by everybody. He is not a controversial figure anywhere. Congresswoman Pingree is a controversial person. He is, on the other hand, not considered as well known in the 1st District, and he doesn't appeal as much to the more liberal constituency in the 1st District. The one thing that I think is interesting in the plight of Maine that goes back a long time is that I think Mainers have a different view of senators than they do of congressmen.
The one who I think of in this case is David Emery, the former congressman who ran for Senate quite some time ago now, although he's been back in politics since then. He was considered a real representative of his district, and people liked him as a congressman. When he ran for Senate, I think they didn't think he was ready to fill those shoes. And I think there is a little bit of that in the perceptions of Pingree and Mishu. She is considered a person who can play on the national stage. I'm not sure that he is.
All right, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Brunswick and Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an independent voter, always have been, and I think I always will be. But I've been very appreciative of and proud of Maine senators, and particularly Olympia Snow. Senator Snow has exercised thoughtful, honest work, and I feel like she has shown her integrity and demonstrated that she's a thinker who considers each issue that comes up. And I'm really saddened to hear that she's leaving. And I'm frustrated, too, because I feel as though she's leaving because of the bully mentality that's been just inflating and growing for some time now, but this extreme partisanship, which leads to, you know, an inability for Congress to work together and actually solve problems. I can understand her frustration with it, but I'm actually very concerned that if she leaves and other similar thoughtful thinkers who are not just playing some kind of political game of football throw up their hands and leave, as they have over the past few years, and it looks like more will, then we just leave the bullies in Congress. And to me, that's an unthinking and outdated mode, and it's not helping anybody. And I'm concerned that we need to correct it, and we need the level-headed thinkers who know how to collaborate and work together, no matter what party they're with, to stay there and work this out. So,
let me ask our guests, is there a disappointment in Washington, for example, that Senator Snow didn't sort of stay and fight it out, or, you know, gave in to the bullies, as Susan termed it?
I would say there is some disappointment of that kind in Washington among those who still have a sense that the Senate should be different from the House, that the Senate should be a somewhat above-the-fray body. Now, that may be a rather idealistic notion. Maybe it's an anachronistic notion. But earlier, as Sandy referred to, there was an idea, certainly in Maine, that if you were going to be a United States senator, you needed to be a national figure or someone who was of the gauge that would be appropriate for a role on the national stage, an Ed Muskie, a Bill Cohen, a George Mitchell, people of that nature who, if they weren't going to be in the Senate, would move on to other enormously important jobs, perhaps in the cabinet or something of that nature. I think that is something that was not unique to Maine, although particularly strong there, and that people used to have this notion that a senator should be a former governor, and often it was a former governor, or someone who was of long-standing distinction in the community before they turned their sights on the United States Senate. More recently, the dominant mode has become former House member. We've had more and more members of the House getting elected to the Senate and bringing with them from the House something of a combative style, us against them, totally partisan, strict majority rules, oftentimes bills brought to the floor with no amendments, things of that nature, which are inimical to the old spirit of the Senate and which have contributed, it's not the only factor, but contributed to undermining the old sense of what the Senate was about. And I think the departure of Olympia Snow is seen as part of that trend.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from the senator interviewed this morning by Maine Watch host Jennifer Rooks. We also want to hear from you. Questions, comments, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page while you're there. Friend us, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
I understand. She said, I can't do any more, and it's just like you're going to be banging your head against the wall. And a little disappointed in that sense, but On the other hand, I can understand, you know, enough is enough.
I wasn't going to support her. I only like her. I don't actually agree with her. She's a sweet person. I mean, she's made Maine look good. She doesn't come off as being a bruiser, and she votes wrong on tons of pieces of legislation. I would have looked at her primary opponents. I know that there are some, or at least one, and I don't know much about him, and I would have had to look in. I know that the primary is a few months away, so I had some homework to do.
I was surprised, and yet based on her reason as far as the Congress and the problems that they're having trying to get anything through it, I can understand where she's coming from. Definite loss for Maine, and there'll be a real scramble now to maintain a Republican in Congress.
I think Olympia Snowe was the smartest person in Congress. People say it takes courage to be independent-minded. That's true, but it also takes brains, because you don't have anybody coming to your defense, because no one's going to help you out. You got to have brains, and she was smart. Not the smartest woman, the smartest person. And this state will be hard-pressed to find anybody to replace her.
And that's from some people from Simona's hot dog stand in Lewiston yesterday. It's a favorite political stomping ground of Senator Snowe's. In fact, her picture's on the wall eating her favorite hot dog, steamed with mustard. And that was owner Jimmy Simonis, who was a long supporter of Senator Snowe, Peter Jensen of South Paris, Joe Rafferty of Turner, and Peter Robinson of Lewiston. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the fallout from the surprise announcement this week that Senator Olympia Snowe would not seek a fourth term in the U.S. Senate. And my guests are Professor Sandy Maisel of Colby College. We also have Ron Elving, NPR News Senior Washington Editor. Are you still there with us, Ron?
Yes, I am.
Do you have a few more minutes to spend with us?
Yes, I can be with you for a few more minutes.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. And joining us just a minute ago in the studio is WCSH. I guess you're a veteran now, aren't you, Pat?
I'm afraid so. The scars to prove it.
Pat Callahan to join the conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. And as we promised, we are going to go now to an interview with Senator Snowe conducted earlier this morning by Maine Watch host Jennifer Rooks.
Senator, you made this announcement 2 weeks until the filing deadline. Some people say that gives the Republican Party a disadvantage. Do you believe that's the case?
You know, I don't. Obviously, I think, you know, I understand, you know, if there had been time earlier in making this decision, but I had so many commitments and I was working and focusing on my campaign for a year and a half, particularly now having a primary, which was the first time that I've ever had a primary. And I had to build a great organization and also to raise a substantial amount of money. So I didn't really have the opportunity to consider the entirety of this decision ultimately in terms of where I stood in my own life. And so, you know, it came when it did. And I have an organization that can assist candidates to get those signatures. So I think that's the point. I can be very useful in that regard in assisting the candidates. It certainly is possible to get those signatures.
We've spoken several times over the years, and you've long expressed your frustration with the increasing partisanship on Capitol Hill and in the nation at large. Was there a straw that broke the camel's back? That really, was there one thing or a set of things that happened that turned this frustration into this decision?
No, actually not. I think it was you know, sort of a pattern and a culture that's developed in the Senate. It's a wonderful institution. I have a passion for public service, and I believe in the essence of it, and that is to solve problems. But as I started to weigh where I was in my life and at my age and what was whether or not it was going to change in the next 6 years in which I would have to make a commitment, that was all sort of in the back of my mind about how, you know, I could make a difference in the Senate in committing another 6 years when things might possibly not change from what it should be as an institution to work on behalf of the people of this country, especially during these tough times. So in any event, that's what really got me to thinking about it all, and that ultimately culminated in a very difficult, wrenching decision, I have to say. You know, it's not anything that I would wish on anybody in having to make this type of decision, but I thought it was important to be honest and true to the people of Maine who have given me this tremendous privilege for so many years to serve them, and that they've invested their trust in me.
Senator Snow, in the New York Times, your cousin Georgia Thomas states that you have been hounded by the Tea Party, specifically the Tea Party in Maine. What did she mean by that, and was that a factor in your decision?
Gee, I haven't talked to her about that. I didn't even realize about that comment. Well, obviously, I think that there are some members of the Tea Party who would not have supported me, but on the other hand, I have had enormous support from other members of the Tea Party because of the numerous meetings that I held with them for, you know, more than a year before I started, you know, getting involved in the organization, the fundraising. I began a series of meetings with various members of Tea Parties. They're disparate groups, so they're not homogenized. They don't come under one umbrella. So I had the opportunity to visit with them, to talk with them, to express my views, to hear their concerns about, you know, either my voting record and so on. So I was able to draw, you know, a considerable amount of support, and including the governor, Governor LePage, who endorsed my candidacy, and he was broadly backed by the Tea Party. So that really made a profound difference for me as well. There are others, obviously, who didn't support me, and that was evident as well. But I was in a good position where I was up until this, you know, this last week when I made my decision.
All right, and the final question, as you know, there's speculation you will be running for president. Is that true?
No, it isn't, Jennifer. I'm not contemplating that whatsoever.
And that's Senator Snow, who spoke earlier today with Jennifer Rooks, host of Maine Watch. And Ron Elving, I know you have to go, but before you do, I just want to follow up on that last question, because there has been a lot of activity in the blogosphere about Snow teaming up possibly with David Boren in the Americans Elect initiative. Is that just idle gossip, or
it's in the category of speculation? I don't believe it's entirely idle, in the sense that people are trying to think of tickets under the Americans Elect voting rubric, and this is a new group that has qualified on many ballots around the state and the country, and is hoping to be in all 50 states. And they're going to have an online convention. We don't know exactly what that'll look like yet, but they're going to try to nominate a Republican with a Democratic running mate, or a Democrat with a Republican running mate. And they're going to try to provide the voters with an alternative or an option in the November vote that would be perhaps conventional, but not. Democratic or Republican explicitly. That would be an alternative to the two major parties and nominees, presumably President Obama and perhaps Mitt Romney. And I could imagine some people becoming quite excited about the prospect of a Snow Boren or a Boren Snow ticket. And I could imagine it being quite a lively subject of conversation in the months ahead. But she seems to be disclaiming any interest in it.
Any final thoughts before you go?
Just that I think that the possibility of 2012 being something like 1992 as a year that is excellent for women to run for statewide office. In 1992, they called it the Year of the Woman. We suddenly got a huge surge in the number of women in the Senate. And I could see, in some respects, 2012 being like that for certain candidates in certain states, particularly with respect to the contraception issue and some of the other things on the social issue side that are coming to the fore.
Ron Elving, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ron Elving, NPR News Senior Washington Editor, joining us by phone from Washington. And now into our studio, Pat Callahan. Thanks for coming in. And we haven't had a chance to talk yet. But,
no, good to see you, Keith.
Let me ask your impressions. You've been covering Maine politics for a long time. How big a deal is this? How is 2012 shaping up?
Well, it's a big deal in that we've changed the whole landscape. We had a pretty good sense of how things were going to shake out. It's true. I've been covering politics in Maine since 1979, which was Olympia Snow's first year in Congress. And so it's going to be strange to not have her as part of the delegation, because she's always been there doing that. But, you know, we saw she had what was really as safe as a seat can be. So she was going to continue on in the Senate. And both of the congressional seats, while there were contests, especially in the 2nd District, it didn't look as though things were going to change much. Now everything is changing. Well, we have the possibility of having all three of those seats with new occupants come next January. So it's a big, big deal.
1-800-399-3566. I'm with Pat Callahan of WCSH and Professor Sandy Maisel of the Goldfarb Center of Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. And we have you as well. And in fact, let's go now to Bill, who is near Augusta. Bill, I noticed that you're not in Augusta.
No, not yet. the going is pretty slow.
Okay. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Well, it's not so much a question as a comment. When I spoke with Olympia Snow at the Kennebec Caucus, I had every indication that she was looking forward to running. However, two of the local wunderkind who were dismissing her as being a rhino and were touting the snow removal signs got up to do their little jargon and were very disingenuous and very negative about Olympia Snow. And I think she has done a remarkable job standing up for the people of Maine. But when the people of Maine no longer appreciate you, then maybe it's time to just walk away.
Well, Bill, the real rhino, somebody wrote recently, you know, is a tough-skinned animal. Is it not reasonable to raise the question about whether she might have, you know, sort of stuck it out and made a case for moderation in the Senate rather than just sort of get out?
Well, what we're seeing, unfortunately, and it's not difficult to predict for the last 20 years, is the complete polarization of the parties. The far left are being very vocal, and the far right are being very vocal. And as you know, in politics, facts and reality often are not the precedent. A lot of things were said about Olympia Snow's voting record, which were patently false. But yet at the Republican caucus, people were cheering ecstatically and shouting, you know, it's time for snow removal and all these things. So, again, I mean, I'm a behavioral psychologist, and I know that even though you're doing a good job, you know that you're doing a good job, but when the people that you're working so hard for no longer appreciate your efforts, then, you know, it sort of pulls the rug out from under you.
You know, I think you make a good point in that I understand from a lot of reports I've heard she was treated pretty badly at some of the caucuses. And it's not that she's used to having people question her votes, but she is not used to having people question her integrity. So I think that did have something to do with the timing of this, where she finally just decided, is it worth it? Should I keep banging my head against the wall here?
It's more than just banging the head against the wall. It's also the fact that the tone of civility in politics out on the stump and in politics in Washington is just very different from what she grew up with.
Well, listener Ann writes in and says, Senator Snow is smart to recognize that she's no longer effective in the U.S. Senate. How much better it would be for the country if all U.S. senators recognize that fact. Mm-hmm. Snow's action is much closer to the original intent of the writers of our Constitution than are the actions of those who stay way beyond their sell-by dates. She has been in 33 years.
And, you know, when George Mitchell left the Senate and when Bill Cohen left, they both cited that as well, saying this doesn't need to be a lifelong position. We come here and we try to get some work done and then we move on to something else.
I think that's right, but I disagree with the caller's premise or the writer's in call premise that she hasn't been effective in the Senate. I think in issue after issue, in fact, she has been effective, whether I've agreed with her or not. I think that the question is whether she thought she could do that going forward from here.
Let's talk about the potential for an independent. We've been talking about the Democrats and the Republicans here, but there is an opportunity for an independent force to enter here. Pat Callahan, what are you looking to your crystal ball here?
Well, we know there are two potential strong independent candidates who are considering this race. One is Elliot Cutler, although a lot of us feel that he really wants to be governor and would like to take on Governor Paul LePage again in a couple of years if LePage is running again. And the other is Angus King. And the interesting thing about former Governor King is that he essentially comes into this with nothing to lose. He doesn't have a seat to give up at this point. It doesn't damage his reputation if he were to get in and lose as an independent. But you have to ask, what does he have to gain? And I think it's a philosophical thing for him in a way. I think he'd like to see, what can you accomplish in Washington as an independent, a middle-of-the-road kind of guy, rather than just in theory where you talk about it? What happens if I go there and with my point of view and the things I did in Maine to try to cobble together a coalition, can that work down there? And I suspect that's what he's thinking about.
Governor King has been involved with groups for the last at least 6 years that have looked at a third way or running candidates who are not Democrats or Republicans, but who are looking to solve problems rather than be just Democrats or Republicans. So I agree with Pat that I think that would greatly appeal to him.
But wouldn't an independent be even more isolated than a moderate Republican?
That's a possibility. The independent who's someone like a Bernie Sanders probably would be. But Angus King has proven he has an ability to he's got a lot of charm and personality, and he's a good negotiator. So he may feel, and rightly so, that he can actually try to bring some people together and pick off some people on each side to sort of see things his way, rather than just sell his vote to one or the other.
Is either party concerned, though, that an independent is going to play the same role that they did in the governor's race, which was in effect the independents argue against this, but that they could serve as a spoiler?
The Democrats certainly have the most to worry about from that, because if anything, Angus King would skew more to the left than to the right. And the thinking among some people is, let's say Peter Chinquet is your Republican nominee, that gives him an extra advantage because Angus King would draw more from Shelley Pingree or Mike Michaud, for example, than he would from a Chinquet.
So might multiple independents sort of cancel out that effect?
That's possible. I have this feeling, too, that wherever Elliot Cutler is coming down on this, he probably doesn't want to be in it with Angus King as well.
I think he's actually said that he won't run against – if King is running as an independent, he won't run.
That makes sense.
1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Kenny Bunk and Tom. Hi, Tom. Yeah, welcome to the program.
I have a little different take on it. I think Washington has been broken for more than probably as long as Snow has been there, and I think it's a good sign that she's not running again, because when it gets right down to it, there's only a couple hundred people that control this country, and if one of those people can't make a difference, they need to get out, and they shouldn't be there for a career. And another thing, public servant, they call himself public servant. Well, if I made $200,000, I mean, public servant sounds like you're working for free. They get a lot of money to be there.
Tom, of the field, who would you like to see go to Washington?
I would definitely prefer an independent. And my I have a question, and I don't know if this is the time to ask it, but do you have to be an attorney? Because that's another problem I see with Washington, D.C. We have too many attorneys there.
Mike Michaud's not an attorney. He drives a forklift, remember?
Okay.
And Olympia Snow is not an attorney.
Scott Brown drives a truck, but unfortunately, only get 10 miles a gallon, so he should be driving a Toyota or a Ford Focus. But anyway.
All right. Tom, thanks for joining the program today. 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Sydney. And let's see. Tom, is that you?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My name's Tom, also. My question, well, not really a question. I'd like to raise an issue that your guests might address. And you played right into my call. Just before the previous call, you talked about multiple candidates, independents, and third-party candidates, and the spoiler effect. And what I would like to hear some comments on is the possibility of changing our voting system, which is geared to two parties and winner-take-all, and changing it to a ranked choice voting system where people don't have to vote for the lesser of evils. They can actually vote their conscience.
I defer to the professor on this one.
Sandy?
And so I'd like to hear some comments about that.
The ranked voting system, which is actually now used in Portland for the mayoral elections, is a fascinating sort of change that has been going on and going across the country, I think, quite slowly. It basically says that you say who's your first choice candidate, your second choice candidate, your third choice candidate, however many are running, and
And as each candidate, after each counting, the bottom candidate drops out and votes are reapportioned, it would have exactly the effect that Tom just said, and I think its chances of being adopted statewide in the state of Maine are virtually none. And it's a classic problem of the chickens guarding, of the wolves, the foxes guarding the chicken coop, because the caller is right, the current system benefits the two-party system.
But, you know, Sandy, I think it's interesting as a practical matter. In Portland, it didn't change the outcome of that race based on what everyone through either polling or just gut feelings
right.
said, that Mike Brennan was going to finish first in that. And after all the ranked choice was done, he did finish first. And so that was not a surprise. You know, the reason people keep talking about this as a statewide thing is are those who are unhappy with Governor Paul DePage
Absolutely.
Being elected as a minority. But we've so many of our governors have been elected with less than 50% of the vote, and it's just
and our presidents are very frequently elected with 50% of the vote, and that's exactly the case. And it, where it has an effect is in a three-person race where two people are sort of aligned and taking the same vote, and the third person is and wins with a plurality, not a majority. And it has happened in many cases. Maine is given an example. There was a case a number of years ago in a congressional district in New Mexico where Heather Wilson is a Republican, won with about 40% of the vote, and there was a Democratic candidate and a Green candidate together who got 60% of the vote. There's a good theoretical argument for it. It's very difficult to see the practical argument for it. If Tom or others are interested, there's a website called fairvote.org, which goes into great detail about what ranked voting looks like.
And from a practical point of view, it's also sort of complicated, isn't it, to sort of decipher the results?
No, it isn't complicated to decipher the results because they're done on a computer. It is difficult to explain the system to people. I happen to have a great deal of faith in the American people that if the people in Burlington, Vermont, and San Francisco, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and other places, and the entire country of Ireland, can understand it, the American people can as well.
But you're right, Sandy. It makes a lot more sense in a three-way race than a 15-way race, that's which right. is what
that's
Portland what, had.
That's where it makes sense in a 15-way race if you're electing five candidates.
Yeah.
If you're electing one, it doesn't make any sense at all.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. To Peaks Island now, and Robert. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I've got a question. Mike Michoud, sponsored, is one of the co-sponsors of the House version of the Blunt Amendment, which just was put off today in the Senate. And I'm wondering if his stance on that is something that helps him a lot more as a House candidate and harms him as a statewide Senate candidate.
That's a good question. I think that may be so. I think it has been helpful for him in the 2nd District to convince some Republicans to go his way, and he doesn't make a lot of noise about his position on that, but he's firm about it, and it could be that wouldn't play as well in the 1st District.
I totally agree, and it wouldn't play well with women statewide.
Pat, we asked Sandy this question earlier about how each of these candidates, that is Pingree and Michoud, kind of play on a outside of their own district in the statewide profile. What else do you see as Michoud having as a challenge as a statewide candidate?
I think that one of his challenges is, first of all, as a positive, people genuinely like him. He's a good guy. He's a smart guy. And they like the fact that he is a blue-collar worker. Some people will say, and it's sort of amusing in a way, I like him because he's not a career politician. Well, he was in the legislature for 22 years, and he's been in Congress, for 12 years now, something, whatever it is. And the fact is, yes, but in the legislature, you're part-time, and he still worked at the mill. And the idea of having a blue-collar guy representing you in Washington, that's a rare thing, and I think it's a good thing. So that's a plus for him. As a negative, he's not as good a campaigner on the stump and in debates as Shelley Pingree would be. And Shelley Pingree is also tested on the statewide level. Now, she lost to Susan Collins and lost pretty handily, but she at least will have learned from that some of the things you do and don't do, and that'll serve her well if, in fact, she is the one who's in this primary with him.
Robert, you're on Peaks Island. Would you support Mike Michoud for Senate?
I probably would as a Democrat. I mean, if he's the nominee, I certainly would be. My real concern is that I'm worried about losing that House seat in the 2nd District. And, you know, if Mike stays, it's certainly a lot safer seat than if it gets picked up. You know, I would certainly hate to see that picked off by the Republicans and have them keep the House because of it.
That's certainly what national Democrats are worried about. I have this feeling that Mike Michaud is getting a lot of pressure from Democrats nationally who say they'd prefer to see a clear path for Shelley Pingree in this and keep that 2nd District seat, which he has a pretty good chance of hanging on to.
As we talked about this earlier, it was kind of a consensus that Senate, that carrot out there, the Senate seat is so valuable that they're sort of willing to, you know, open up both House seats if it comes to that.
They don't want to, naturally, Democrats don't want to lose control of the Senate, and a seat that was solid Republican is now in play, and you can't not make a strong play for it.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. More with Pat Callahan of WCSH News Center 6. A veteran political reporter, and Professor Sandy Maisel, director of the Goldfarb Center of Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College. And we want to hear from you. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. On the line from Colby College, Professor Sandy Maisel, director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement, and in studio Pat Callahan, WCSH News Center 6 anchor and political reporter. Welcome back to you both, and of course to our listeners. And Janet has sent us an email asking, why is nobody talking about Tom Allen in the run for the Senate? Pat?
That is a good question. And when we first got the news a couple of days ago and you start imagining who are the people that might make a run for it, who are the Democrats who have stature, Tom Allen is certainly one of them. I have not spoken to him, so I don't know what he's thinking. I don't think he's taken papers out. But I know his run against Susan Collins was kind of an all or nothing. This was his chance to either move up or move out. And I don't know if he still has the hunger to go back to the United States Senate right now. It wouldn't surprise me if he did decide to make a run. But I think maybe he feels, you know, I took my shot and it didn't work out. So let's do something else.
I agree with that. I think he would be a terrific candidate if he wanted to. I've seen no evidence that he wants to. He's working with the American Publishers Association now, and I think is enjoying the private sector.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Belfast. And Steve. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program. Steve, are you there? I guess we don't have Steve. So instead, let's go to Belgrade and Stephanie. Stephanie, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, yes. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks. Yeah, so I'm curious of what seems to be a total lack of attention paid to the move towards caucusing from primary elections and how that plays maybe to the more strident voices.
Go ahead.
Well, I assume you're talking about the presidential election. I don't think there actually has been a move towards caucusing. It's been roughly the same number in recent years. There was a huge move towards primaries in the 1970s, 70, 72, 76, and 78, and it's been pretty steady since that time. You are right, however, that the argument at caucuses tend to be more strident than they do in primaries. The Republican Party battle to the contrary notwithstanding.
And of course, if you're talking about on the Maine level where we have caucuses to have presidential preference instead of a primary, we had the primaries in 96 and 2000. The turnout did not really increase. They're more expensive to do. Some towns and cities balk at the idea of having to have a special one-day election. You can't really have it on the same day as the June primary because it's too late to really be have an impact in the process, so there's no point in doing that. And I think in 2004, when the Democrats still controlled the legislature, a lot of them wanted to go back to the caucus because they were John Kerry supporters and wanted to make sure that system where you can bus in your supporters would pay off for him and not give him some embarrassing loss.
That's right on both counts. You know, we had a long history of the primaries until 96 and of the caucuses until 96 and moved for just those two cycles. A lot of the concern to move was to get more people to vote and also to have more influence. And what we found out was that fewer people vote or very few people voted, and we had no influence.
Let's go to Belfast and Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Something that hasn't come up at all is we're talking about various candidates and who might run and whether or not we're going to have independents running. One thing I think we need to keep in mind is that Maine really doesn't operate in a bubble in terms of our elections and who wins races. By that I mean that there is a tremendous amount of outside money that is going to come pouring into the state because we have an open Senate seat. And we saw some of that get into campaigns, even legislative campaigns, 4 years ago and 2 years ago. And I wonder about the impact of super PAC money, of national committee money pouring into Maine, which it's going to do, in terms of the voice of an independent candidate being able to be heard amidst this onslaught.
Yeah, Pat, that's going to be good for your sales department.
Well, that's true. I mean, they were already you already assumed there's going to be a lot of money spent on the same-sex marriage ballot question.
Right.
But it's certainly true that we saw in the last cycle, for the first time in my recollection, TV ads going after legislative candidates mm-hmm. from outside sources, and I think those paid off in general. So
right.
There's certainly going to be more of that, and it's an insidious process, and there's not really anything anyone can do about it at this point. And how an independent breaks through, it has to be someone who's well-financed and without a party to depend on. That becomes a much tougher row to hoe.
Well, I think I don't mean to disagree totally, but slightly, which is the parties have always been able to do that and have done it. It is really these super PACs that I think you have to be concerned about, and there is no logical reason that a super PAC couldn't come in favoring an independent as much as one of the candidates. This guy who is backing Senator Santorum, Foster Freeze, has said he is going to invest heavily in seven figures into five senatorial races this year, and he's going to pick small states. And Pat's exactly right, in both Pat, the reporter and Pat, the caller, are exactly right that they can have an incredible undue effect. And because of the Supreme Court cases in First Citizens United and then Speech Now, there's nothing that one can do to restrict that.
So the independent just has to find his own billionaire, and that's how they'll succeed.
Or the billionaire has to find the independent.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's something hard to do. And I think with both parties very, very focused on getting Olympia Snow's seat, that Maine is really going to be under siege in a way that the state has never been before in terms.
You're right. You're right. Brace yourself.
Pat, do you think that we're going to see, you know, the really sort of negative ads that heretofore we haven't seen much of?
You haven't seen them from the candidates or really from the parties too much, because they have a sense, I like to think, that Maine voters don't buy that stuff. However, once you deal with these super PACs who can do and say whatever they want, as much as they want, I think you are going to see a lot more negative campaigning for this Senate seat, maybe for the congressional seats as well.
I think that's right. You know, back in the dark ages, Pat and I remember this, I think it was 30 years ago when Senator Mitchell was being challenged by David Emery. There are a bunch of outside groups who were going to come in running negative ads, and Mitchell and Emery had a press conference together saying we don't want it, and we kept them out. I just don't think that'll happen anymore.
No, I don't think it could happen, even if the candidates said that. I don't think it would work.
No, I don't think they would have any effect.
In some cases, the candidates like it but say they don't like it. I suspect here they actually don't like it.
Yeah, you're right. When Mitt Romney or somebody says, no, I wish they wouldn't do that, well, they're softening up your opponents. Of course you like it. But you know, I think people in Maine and those who are running for office have different sort of expectations.
I totally agree with that.
And this is probably the same question, but there will be a lot of outside influences in this Maine election, which, as we are saying, the candidates may not have much control over. I'm not sure what the question is. I guess I'm thinking out loud there.
Well, candidates like to control their own message, and they can't control their own message when the people from outside are coming in who, by law, cannot coordinate the message with them. So that, you know, what we have seen is around the country is outside groups coming in doing the negative and candidates doing the positive. But in a state like Maine where people don't want the negative, they can't control that that's not going to happen.
And, you know, Sandy, it's interesting. We spoke with George Mitchell a couple of weeks ago, and I asked him about the whole super PAC business. And he said, and this is a guy who understands the law and the history of it, he said throughout the United States history, there have been a handful of Supreme Court decisions that were damaging to the republic. He says, you know, Dred Scott. And he says the Citizens United decision that opened the way for these super PACs, he says, will be remembered as one of those. He said it was a terrible decision, and it's an ill wind that blows no good.
Senator McCain, Republican, and ex-Senator Feingold, Democrat, both have said the exact same thing.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Before I forget, this is sort of a technical question, which is Olympia Snow had, I think, somewhere around $3 million in her war chest. And someone had asked me, what happens to that money now?
Well, she's got a number of options. She can give it to a political committee, but not to a committee backing a particular candidate. She can give it in small donations to particular candidates, but only up to the maximum limit of $2,500. She can give it to any charity that she'd like to give it to, or she can take it for herself and declare it as income.
But she also, I think, Sandy, correct me if I'm wrong, if any donors want the money back, she has to return it.
She can return. I don't believe she has to.
Oh, okay. I know Senator Mitchell said when he left and he had the big war chest, he said anyone who wants it back can have it.
Right.
The rest of it is going to go into the scholarship fund, which still exists.
That's right.
Let's go to Kenny Bunk, Port, and Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
That's great.
Go ahead.
I've got a couple, very short question. I'm wondering about Lawrence Lessig and Change Congress and how Susan feels about that.
Olympia Snow, you mean?
Olympia, right.
Yeah. Sandy, any thoughts?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Never heard her speak on the subject.
Yeah.
No, nor have I.
And that makes
all
three.
Right. Well, basically, it has to talk about lobbying.
No, I know the book, but you asked what Senator Snow thinks about it. I have no idea.
Right. All right.
All right. Thanks, Jeff. 1-800-399-3566. And to let's go to Booth Bay and Jean. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I don't have a question, really, but I'm glad to have a voice. I'm an independent voter. I praise Senator Snow for her effectiveness and also for helping Maine businesses. And we're going to lose that seniority in the Senate on committees. That bothers me.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. What is the effect of a freshman senator coming in and committee assignments and all of that? Do we lose a lot of influence?
Sure. It takes a while for anybody, whoever the next senator is, to build up that sort of background. It's one of the arguments a member of Congress will make when they say, well, look, I've been around Washington long enough. I know the players. I know the committees to be on. So that's what they'll tout as the reason to elect them rather than someone who's completely new. But there's no denying it. It makes a difference, and it's hard to get the assignments you want off the top.
It's absolutely true. And she was in line if the Republicans take over the Senate to become the chairman of the Commerce Committee. There's actually a funny story about Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah, who was arguing that he should be elected because if he isn't, he actually was in line. She was next in line. That if he wasn't reelected, Olympia Snow would be head of the Commerce Committee. Of course, now Olympia Snow would not be head of the Commerce Committee if he's not elected. In fact, it would go to, I think, Senator Crapo, who's more conservative than he is.
Gina, you're looking at the field of candidates as they emerge.
Yeah. I immediately thought of Elliot Cutler before I heard he was interested. Then when I heard Angus King was interested, I certainly would vote for him. And I am an independent. I would prefer Shelley Pingree and Michaud would do their work for Maine in the House and stay put. A lot of independents in the state of Maine. I wish I knew the percentage. And if more independents all over the country would run, eventually this would help this current gridlock that we're all angsting over. So thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Jane.
Okay,
Sandy. Let's just follow up on her point. If there is this sort of growing, independence, or particularly in Maine, if independence is an important characteristic, then why isn't that reflected in Congress? Why is that partisan rift emerging as opposed to reflecting what might be happening in society? Or is American society actually becoming more partisan, more polar?
There's a real question among political scientists whether American society is becoming more partisan or whether it is only the elites. But the fallacy in Gene's argument is that all independents agree with each other. There are independents who think the parties are both too liberal, and there are independents who think both the parties are too conservative, and there are independents who are, focus only on green issues, and there are independents who focus only on taxpayer issues, and they don't agree. That's why they call themselves independents, but there is not an independent party. There are people who decide they do not want to be enrolled in one of the other parties.
And indeed, some independents are so libertarian, we're not sure where they are. It's almost a circle of ideology.
That's right.
That they occupy. 1-800-399-3566.
That's sort of the Ron Paul people who come around the backside and are in favor of isolationism and no involvement in wars because they are that libertarian.
There's the libertarian belief in legalizing marijuana, which
right.
might be perceived as a very liberal belief. But anyway, 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to Belfast and Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steve, go ahead, please.
I think my ultimate race would be Les Houghton as a Republican, Peter Biggio as a Democrat, and Elliot Cutler as an independent. Then we'd have some real choice for some people who actually got something done. And I no disrespect to the folks that have run over the years, but if you look since 1990, our leaders in Washington have gone from $97,000 a year to over $170,000 a year with full benefits, premium pensions, and the rest of Maine is like sinking. And I think at the end of the day, you can give kudos to anybody you want, but what have those folks done for real Mainers, people who cannot feed their families, do not have a job, can't heat their house, and we're talking about spending clean election money for a bunch of people who've already got their own. So I think we need to have, I think we need more than just fresh ideas. We need people who have a history of actually doing something in an economy, creating jobs, building wealth, and bringing their employees or the people that they work with along. And I don't think anybody other than you've mentioned Elliot Cutler, the rest of them are just, they've already had their chance, and they haven't done anything, in my estimation, to improve the wealth and economic outlook of the state of Maine. And we're a sinking ship, and we need someone that knows how to command the ship and get it going. And that would be my ultimate candidates for Maine.
Let's bring our guests into this. Does the sort of the immediacy of the economic situation trump, the august, history of someone's public service over 30 years?
Well, it certainly makes sense that you want somebody who understands where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in creating jobs and wealth. But government is not run like a business. And, I think you can look at it on the smaller scale with Governor LePage, who has butted heads with the legislature, expecting them to do what he says because he's from the business world and the people that work for him do what he says. The legislature doesn't work for him, and so it's a negotiation process, and that's a different sort of different breed of cat, so to speak.
And they don't work for him because they, in fact, represent people who have different views from each other and from his, and he has difficulty reflecting that. I sort of, if the caller wants somebody of the nature that he was talking about, then you want somebody who's had both kinds of experiences. If you were a Republican and running for president, you'd probably look at Mitt Romney. I suppose you could argue that Governor King has had both kinds of experiences.
Yeah, you could.
Steve, is there anything wrong with having experience in Washington?
Well, no. What I'm saying is, again, we're applying the old sensibilities where our own little clique in Maine. Maine is such a small state. Everybody we're talking about, they're all great friends. They go to cocktail parties together. I'm saying if you look at their records, I debate anybody to say that if you go to Piscataquis County, Penobscot County, Aroostook County, from Limestone, the loss of the Air Force Base, all these people who have been on big committees and big influence have not
kept anything for the average Mainer. And I debate anybody that believes that, you know, they're great people. I agree. But, you know, they haven't done anything. They have not been effective. And we're trying to get this. We're just changing happy to glad with a candidate base that most of us are talking about, other than maybe Elliot Cutler. That's why I'd like to see a Les Otten and Peter Vigue and Elliot Cutler, who have had all that experience of working with that type of thing. You need people that, and I don't think most of the candidates on the Democrat and Republican side that we've talked about in general have that experience in this world we live in.
All right.
And I mean, that's the bottom line.
All right, Steve, thanks for calling. Let's just follow up on this. Is there a sense among do people back home sometimes not understand what exactly their senator or congressperson is doing for them?
That's probably true. Well, Sandy, just give me one second. I mean, I think the most important thing a member of Congress does is constituent service. The fact is, if you're there as a member of Congress from the state of Maine, your influence is limited until you've been there for 25 years, probably. So your biggest job is to make sure the people back home are getting their Social Security checks or smoothing the path for whatever other government issue they have. Otherwise, you're there to vote yes and no on things.
Well, that's a little more stark than I would put it, but certainly both senators and congressmen put a great deal of their staff work, a majority of their staff work, into doing constituent service, and well, they should, for the reasons that Pat is talking about. I think the real problem lies with candidates who promise to do things that they can't do. And this is candidates for president, candidates for senator, candidates for governor, candidates for Congress. We live in a system in which we have separation of powers and checks and balances, and one person does not snap the fingers and say, do this, and it happens. We have to, in fact, convince people who represent varying constituencies that have different views about what is the best public policy. And that's why Senator Snow, I think, to sort of bring this full circle, is so discouraged, because she understands that system. And what we have in Washington now are people who are not willing to compromise, not willing to seek proximate solutions to very perplexing problems, but rather saying it's my way or the highway. And she was exactly right in that. You can't have it's my way or the highway and get an effective government done.
And, you know, Sandy, you talked a couple of minutes ago about how independents don't all see eye to eye. They're not all heading in the same direction. I think that's the Republican Party's challenge right now, is that there's so many wings of it. There's the deficit hawks and the social issue people. And that's why, you know, that's why Olympia Snow is finding it hard to get anything done, because they've all staked out positions and won't come together.
I think that's right.
We have a tweet that Cutler says he will decide soon on whether he'll run or not, and Angus King says he's seriously considering.
I've seen both of those, and Cutler has also said he will decide after Angus King.
Yeah, right.
And they don't have to decide right away. I mean,
no, they have time.
They have till June 1st to get the signatures. They need twice as many signatures. But
4,000 signatures.
You can do that. You know, certainly by after everybody else is in, they can make the decision at that point.
And, you know, I think a good point to make, we've all been wringing our hands about having only 16 days for potential candidates to gather their signatures before the March 15th deadline to run in the primary. I think if you can't collect 2,000 signatures in 2 weeks, you have no business running.
I think that's right. And I do think maybe it was before you came on, Pat, that I said that the timing of this did give former President Ray has a distinct advantage in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. because he has that organization in place.
That's right.
Let's go to Brunswick and Donald. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I just have a comment. I think that the answer to this whole problem is to have Angus run for Senate, and most likely he would win. Have Cutler challenge LePage in a couple of years. And then leave the two representatives where they are, because I think they're both doing a good job. And then in a couple of years from now, Pingree, where she has more experience, can challenge Susan Collins.
Well, Donald, just call them and tell them. That's what
I'm sure they're listening.
To me, well, thank God we solved that problem.
Yeah.
To me, that's the solution to the whole problem.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Donald. You may get your way. We never know, right?
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Brunswick and Bob.
It is like the
Hi, Bob.
Says, you know, we want the party to make the decision. There is no party that makes the decision. There are individuals who are making decisions.
Sure. Bob, are you there?
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm part of that dying breed of moderate Republicans. I've been a Republican all my long life, and in fact, my mother was the chair of the Republican Party in New Jersey during the years when I was growing up, and they were we were then the party of Lincoln, and the crazies were not a part of the mix. I am very upset by the fact that everybody today is screaming. No, I'm more conservative than you. No, I'm more conservative than you. You know, we're going to eventually, somebody's going to claim to be Genghis Khan. I'm very upset with that. I'm upset with the fact that there aren't the kinds of people, in national government, who were the great moderate Republicans of the past. And, so I think that the loss of Olympia is I think she'll be irreplaceable in that regard. I would hope that my neighbor Angus King will run and take, and I'm sure he's got a better chance than most of winning.
Bob, really quickly, let me ask you how you think your party, your state party, has done in terms of developing a bench to go to in situations like this, or of candidates.
I think that they probably have thought that this was not imminent, and so there hasn't been a whole lot of thought given to who would replace both Olympia and Susan Collins. But you know, we have this tradition of people going back to Bill Cohen and before that what was her name there that stood up to Senator McCarthy,
Margaret Chase.
Unfortunately today everything is who can be more fascist than the next guy?
Yeah, Bob, we're almost about to run out of time, but I want to get back to our guests. How would you assess, Pat, this situation erupted? It's kind of a test of how each party is doing in terms of grooming its spring training, grooming its field of candidates, its team. A quick analysis of how you think each party's done.
Well, I think it's clear, excuse me, if the Democrats have more people ready to go of a higher stature because you have two members of Congress who are eager for this seat. John Baldacci may run for it. He's won statewide elections, been in Congress. So they're tested in a different way. Republicans have candidates that can win a lot of support. I think, you know, Kevin Ray has a strong possibility, Peter Chinquette, but they have not been tested statewide.
Sandy, real quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think actually the Democrats' bench in terms of people running to, at least in the first congressional district, is also stronger than the Republicans is. So it is a sort of small advantage to the Democrats in this as well.
All right, we're out of time. I want to thank our guests, Sandy Maisel, director of the Goldfarb Center of Public Affairs and Civic Engagement at Colby College.
Nice being with you, Keith.
Thank you. And Pat Callahan at WCSH News Center 6, anchor and reporter. Thanks,
Keith.
And thanks to you, all of you who called. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. We had help from Jennifer Rooks, Susan Sharon, and the MPBN web team. You can listen to this conversation and previous editions of Maine Calling by visiting mpbn.net and click on the radio tab. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.